Accession number 23848, reel 10.
Mr. Wildgust, reel 10. Right, Mr. Wildgust, we're talking about your platoon, and you've found the roll book from the platoon from that period. If you could just describe what that is. And
well, it's a book called the Infantry Roll Book, Platoon or Section, and it's for C Company, the 14th Platoon of the Sherwood Foresters Regiment, and it lists by name, rank and number, the date of enlistment, the age on enlistment, whether they were married or single, religion, height, chest, boot size, chest size, weapon classifications, rifle brand, machine gun, etc., etc., pay. But I didn't have, well, I couldn't bother with all that lot, so I put in their army number, their rank, and their date of enlistment, and their trade prior to joining. Well, looking at it, one or two were regulars, or at least men who had joined up before the war began, 1938, 1939, when one was 17, he was a gardener, and the others were, again, we got one at 27, one at 26, one at 18, all joined up early in the war, 1940, the beginning of 1940. All of them may have been called up at that age because conscription had come in by that time. But then we get down to the 19s and the 17s and the 18-year-olds who were joined up in 1942, or were called up. And they were, well, it says here, one was a core maker, a general labourer, a labourer, a slaughterer, a labourer, a joiner, and another labourer, a brick maker, a painter, a turner, a component inspector, and much to my surprise, a couple of police constables who were both aged 26. And I'm surprised in a way that they were called up, unless they volunteered, of course, although my own company commander at the time was an ex-policeman, and I did meet him after the war when he went back to the police force. He was about 6 feet four, and by the name of Brown. But I've got one here, an errand boy, a brass moulder, a labourer, a sawyer's assistant, and a clerk. They were all in their 18s. A machine feeder, a box packer, a machinist, carpenter, a joiner, and believe it or not, a forester.
Now, what was the purpose of the roll book? How was it used on a day-to-day basis within the
company? Well, it was really to keep track of what they were doing. In the remarks column, I've got, for instance, they're on draft. Some of them were sent farming. I've got one or two earmarked here had been transferred to the Lincolns. I kept it really for my own use. There's one here in hospital.
Was it a way, I suppose, of getting to know the men to have this?
Yes, well, it was to keep. I mean, when you took a platoon in the morning, it was a good way of keeping an eye on how many were there and what they were doing. I've got even another list here where I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 were out farming daily. 1, 2, 3, 4 were on a draft. 5 were on a draft. 6 were on a draft. And there's a couple in hospital and a couple on leave.
When you say on a draft, that means they've left the
Yes, they'd been earmarked either to go abroad or wherever, to another battalion or another regiment for that matter.
Was that a common occurrence with this battalion at this period?
Yeah. Yes, we just got orders, or the commanding officer got orders to nominate, really. I think they were probably asked for two officers and 40 men, and they just chose them ad lib. At that time, I came across a brother officer who had just been commissioned, and he was in high dudgeon because they'd asked for a battle-experienced officer, and he was the only one. He'd been with the 8th Foresters in Norway as an NCO. And, of course, he'd experienced battle conditions, And he was a bit annoyed because he said, I'm the only one here that's had battle experience. And he said, they're going to send me back just because of that, which he felt was a bit unfair considering he'd only just recently been commissioned. And as it so happened, he, in North Africa, he was transferred to another regiment, Northamptonshire Regiment, where he got bomb happy. And although he wasn't discharged from the army, his army days really were numbered. He'd had such a rough time in Norway. But that's now a fellow called Frank Cox, actually, but that's another story.
Now, so people were leaving this battalion. Mm-hmm. Had you given any thoughts to that and whether that might happen to you? And was
no,
that something
well,
feeling within the platoon?
See, actually, I joined the battalion in October. And by the time I got my feet in November, we moved to Yarmouth. And then there was only November, December, and there was Christmas. And it was then, after I'd been only three months, that I was told I was on a draft. And you just accepted it.
And did you know what that draft was going to be? Did they tell you?
Well, they told me I was going to the Lincolns. They didn't say where we were going. In fact, we were told at the time that we would most likely have to have a tropical kit. So, of course, we immediately thought of exotic places like India or South Africa or somewhere. And it wasn't until we were in transit, and even then we didn't really know where we were going, that the tropical kit job was forgotten and never drawn and never asked for. That we realised we were going somewhere that was at that time temperate, which in fact it was in North Africa.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we get to that, first of all, when you went on this draft, was it you and members of this platoon, or was it spread out amongst the battalion, amongst the company? I mean, did you know the men that you were going away?
Yes, I knew one or two of them, but not. Only as an officer to the men. I mean, I didn't.
So that the platoon and the company, as it was, would stay. You know, your old platoon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Now, before we talk about your move abroad, I just ask a few more questions about this period on coastal defence. And you mentioned, you know, a kind of a bit of a party spirit towards the Christmas of 42, and just on that subject, you've mentioned various dances and so on, and you've also mentioned the distinctions between officers and soldiers and how you broke those distinctions to an extent. Mm. How would the authorities look on something like, if you're at a dance, you're a lieutenant, and you took an interest in an ATS girl that was in the ranks, or vice versa, or... and also, let's say, one of your men, a lance corporal or a private soldier, took an interest in an ATS officer. Was there any rules about that when you were a dancer?
No, it was never even considered. I don't know, it never occurred anyway. I mean, you'd get it probably in films when some lowly private fell in love with some officer and he was sort of looked upon as a bit of a joke. But it was never thought of. There was no sort of distinction at all. You pleased yourself just like everything else. The only thing that did happen, of course, is that ranks do get segregated because, one, there was the money concern, and although you got what we found, for instance, if the WAFs, who seem to be the ones who ran the dances more than anybody, the RAF were naturally invited. And the RAF generally were paid better than the army. And they had better facilities. So it was natural to see RAF NCOs and men in WAF dances. But you very rarely saw private soldiers and uncommissioned ranks of the army at these dances. They sort of segregated themselves in a way. They went to their own pubs and... they did their own thing, and they no more wanted probably to mix with their superior, if you can call us that, than we wanted them to mix with us.
Was there any rivalry with the RAF or sense of... Were you
people? Not really, only friendly. I mean, the we also came across quite a lot of the Navy there. The Navy invariably, irrespective of what they did, and of course we didn't know what they did, they all came from the submarine. They were all either submariners or in destroyers and had very exciting lives, but probably were only stationed at Burstall on the coast. But we didn't know. I mean, he didn't bother really to inquire any further at which point.
What about the Americans? Had they made their prison?
No, they hadn't arrived by this time. I mean, it was it wasn't until mid-1943 that they had any impact on us. I can't in fact remember seeing an American. I did the second year after I was wounded, when I came home again, the Americans were in force then, up to that period.
We'll talk about it then. Just going back, you mentioned the officer's servant, Batman.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just describe what his duties would be for you as a platoon officer at this period?
Well, he used to get uniform out and keep it in reasonable condition. And I had one who always remembered everything. I mean, he'd say, have you got a handkerchief, or have you got this, or have you got that? And then they were on parade with you. They were with you, whatever you did. You had a batman and a runner. Generally, the runner, of course, did what he's supposed to do, he took messages. But the batman was supposed to stay with the officer all the time, and as a sort of aide-de-camp, I suppose. I mean, he had more time off than the average. I mean, you didn't always want him with you. If you were taking a parade, there was no point in him being with you then. But if you went on a scheme or anything like that, it was his job to be with you all the time.
Was that job looked on as a perk?
Yes, I think it was. They were daft if they didn't make it a perk. Again, it depends on the officer as to whether they got on with them or whether the officer was amenable to having, you know, if he was friendly with them, they were all right. But again, I never came across Batman objecting to the job. In fact, I think they rather liked it.
And you mentioned the man that wanted to be a driver. That was your first Batman. Was he? Was the?
He was a very good Batman, actually. In fact, I did have some very good Batman, and I don't know how many I had altogether, but three or four, I suppose. And I had no problems with them, and we always got on quite well together.
Now,
they didn't intrude in your life at all. I mean, they were just there.
Now, you were sent on this draft. Mm-hmm. Was there any kind of embarkation leave or anything?
Oh, yes, I got embarkation leave. And it coincided with the time that the battalion were doing a lot of rehearsals for the change of number from the 16th of the 1st Battalion. And I can't quite remember the... It would be after New Year, 1943. I think my draft was from about the 2nd or 3rd of January for a fortnight. I think I got a fortnight. Until about the 15th or 16th of January. And then we went back. I'm a bit vague about that, funnily enough. I remember most things, but... all I can remember about New Year's Eve 1942 was that a WAF and I danced in the snow on Yarmouth Pier by getting over barbed wire. I know she came from Blackpool, and that's the end of that. One night of a dance. That was it. I mean, you didn't go any further than that in those days.
Mm. And
you behaved yourself.
Looking at where the war was at this period, had you any kind of preferences about where you wanted to go? Well,
No. It wasn't until we got on the ship we realised probably where we were going, but no, we had no idea. When they mentioned tropical kit, we immediately thought of somewhere like India or Egypt. But of course, by that time, the British were getting on top, and the general opinion was that, well, it's virtually all over now, so there won't be a heck of a lot for us to do.
I mentioned getting on the ship. I mean, you were stationed at Yarmouth. You draft of 30 men. Did you come back from embarkation leave to Yarmouth and then go up as a body?
Yes. I remember we started at Yarmouth with a train of probably three coaches, and it slowly chugged through the night. And I know it stopped at York, by which time, when you looked out of the window, there were about 10 coaches, and then it chugged on a bit further, and the next time there were about 15 coaches. All this was at night, by the way. And when eventually they pulled into Glasgow, you couldn't see the end of the train. I reckon there must have been 25 full coaches on it, and we were quite amazed that an engine could pull all the coaches, and where the heck anybody come from. And they stopped at Glasgow, and the local charitable services like the Red Cross and that gave us a drink, a tea, but otherwise I can't remember eating anything, although I suppose we must have had haversack rations of some sort. But we then went from Glasgow along the Clyde up to Greenock and the whole of the mouth of the Clyde was full of ships, aircraft carriers and destroyers and battleships and transport. There were, I don't know, probably 20 or 30 ships, and we were put in lighters and to take us out to our ship, which was the Durban Castle. Excuse me. And there were two officers who joined then. Somewhere along the line, or at least I met them on the boat, and they said, "You're in cabin so-and-so." It was a twin cabin for three, and of course, being the junior officer, I slept on the floor, and the other two pinched the decent bunks. One fellow, whose name I can't remember, was in the Welsh Fusiliers, and I've forgotten what the other one was in, but I noticed immediately they got on the boat, they'd both decided they'd be ill, and I was left in charge of 60 men for the whole voyage. They never did a thing. In fact, they, as soon as they landed in Algiers, one got himself a job in the local paper and one got himself a job in staff. But they knew the ropes a bit better than I did.
They were older than you.
They were older than me, and a little bit more experience, obviously.
Now, so you arrived with your... How many men, about?
Well, there were 60. 30 were going to the Foresters, and 30 were going to the Lincolns.
Were they all Foresters at this point, these 60 men, or were they...?
Yes, well, they'd all come with me from Yarmouth.
Now, so, who else was on this ship, and what kind of ship was it?
Well, it was the Durban Castle, which was a Union Castle line.
Was it a passenger liner?
Passenger liner. I don't know what, 16,000 tonnes. It was a luxury ship. And because all the castle lines were named after castles, and I don't know whether Durban had got a castle or what, but anyway, it was the Commodore ship. And I don't know how many men were on it, but it was crowded. Apart from that, we who had a cabin, we were quite comfortable. I mean, we're in the sort of, if you can call it, the residential part of the ship, whereas the men were scattered all over the place on decks and below decks, in very cramped conditions. But with us, it was rather like going on a cruise. We found that the dining room, a lot of the furniture had been stacked in corners, and the grand piano had been stacked in a corner. But the tables were set, and the stewards attended to our needs. What amazed us is that when we looked out of the porthole windows, at Glasgow, or Port, the Scottish mainland, we were in a well-lit ship. Was sort of pre-war food. That was the thing that struck us majorly, was that we'd come from England and Britain with brown bread and rationing, very severe rationing, to find ourselves faced with a menu, which I have still got now, which was printed with breakfast, luncheon and dinner. For instance, on the Saturday we had oatmeal porridge or cereal and smoked cod in milk and broiled bacon and grilled pork sausages demi-glace and mashed potatoes and white and wholemeal rolls, which were hot, and preserves and tea and coffee. And on the Sunday lunch there was potage montanara and corned round beef, round of beef with carrots and vegetable curry and rice. Potatoes, baked jacket and snow, and cold baron of beef with horseradish cream and spiced brawn and salad, with stewed pears with cream for coffee. And for dinner, consommé, halibut, roast haunch of mutton, braised duckling or sausage, potatoes of two different types, which I won't bother to translate or pronounce, Savoy cabbage and lemon pudding and coffee. And this was, apart from breakfast there, of frizzled bacon with fried eggs. I mean, we never had seen an egg. If you got one a week, you're lucky. And we couldn't quite understand it. It was just like going on a cruise, the whole setup was.
And how was this food presented in a similar kind of opulent way?
We had waiters and... The waiters were, I suppose, of the Merchant Navy. Most of them were, I don't say all of them, but we didn't even understand what homosexuals were in those days, but a lot of them obviously were. Because during the voyage, they did a ship's concert. Well, a couple of them, who we named Gracie and Deanna, from Gracie Fields and Deanna Durbin, and they had their own... they did their drag acts and sang and danced and the rest of it, and they used to mince along the deck in very tight jeans, if they called them jeans in those days. I forgot what they called them, but I remember on a boat drill once when the ship was in the Atlantic and rolling like hell, and these two stewards sort of minced their way onto the deck, and the Commodore telling them to hurry up with some amusement. And when eventually they got to Algiers, they went off down the gangplank hand in hand with their little patent cases, and made a lot of jeering and whistling from the troops. But these sort of things went over your head. You didn't sort of understand the implications in those days. we were very naive and innocent people.
Now, but, when you were at this kind of quite opulent meal times, Would that be all the officers on the ship?
Yeah.
Would that include the ship's
Navy
officers?
Navy and Army.
So were there Air Force and...
No, I can't remember any Air Force.
How many officers were in transit that were on the ship and were going to get off wherever you got to? And
do you know, I honestly don't know. I'm just trying to picture the... We were at tables of four, and you more or less pleased yourself when you went within a certain time limit. It was January, of course. It was very rough, and I remember one night there was only myself and one or two other people left in the dining room. I mean, even naval officers were walking across the restaurant floor and being sick in the middle of it. So it was pretty rough. But we managed to managed to survive it without being sick. But I suppose there'd be 60, perhaps more, 60 officers of one type or another at any one time.
And that would include the ship's crew as well.
Yeah.
Now, what about the men during this period?
Say that by hearsay, in as much as that people I've met since said that they had a terrible time, their food was awful. And when we did go on deck, as I say, the men were being sick all over the place, and the companionways, I believe they call them, were covered in it, and the decks were covered in it. And of course, once it starts, you never stop. But they had, some had reasonable quarters, but a lot of them were sleeping on the deck, which had been tarpaulined off, in sort of bunks which had been stuck to the side of the promenade decks. And we used to, we had boat drill regularly, and I can't remember what on earth we did with them. I don't think we... I remember asking for volunteers once, but what I asked for, I don't know. And
so there's no training routine at this
point? No, there didn't. No, there was no way, of course, of segregating your lot from anyone else, because it was a big mishmash of troops of all shapes and sizes and arms. And of course, all the time, the crew would say, "Well, the last convoy we had, we lost so many ships, and we're glad it's rough, because while it's rough, there won't be any U-boats about." But apparently we went right into mid-Atlantic, and then south, and then cut back, came down the coast of Portugal for a short time, I remember, because we were interested in the lights from the coast. And we left the, went through the Straits of Gibraltar, and then I remember waking up in that morning, and all of a sudden everything was quiet and there was no sound. You couldn't even really hear the engines, and we sort of ran out of this very turbulent Atlantic into the Mediterranean. It was as smooth as a mill pond, I think is the expression. I remember going on deck about early morning and saw the Atlas Mountains. They were black silhouettes against the most gorgeous sky, and the sea was blue, and I thought, how nice of King George to send us on this nice voyage. In fact, he was quite felt quite privileged to be in such a place. But and also the fact that everything had calmed down. When we went through the Straits of Gibraltar, we lost, I should think, 2/3 of the convoy went straight on down to South Africa, or the south, and we finished up in a very small amount of ships for the last stage into Algiers.
Were there any incidents on the voyage in terms of U-boat scares or anything like that?
No, we didn't get anything. We didn't get an aircraft, or we just, the only time we had with boat stations was purely as a trial.
Now, while you're on the ship, presumably you were able to write, the letters would be sent when you got to your destination. Had your responsibilities, can you remember, you know, the business of the officer having to censor the men's mail?
Yeah, well, you censored your own platoon or company mail. It depends who was interested in censoring it. You weren't supposed to say, obviously, where you were going, but with going to Algiers, of course, most of the men said that they'd just seen Charles Boyer and, forgot her name now, the actress that was in the film Algiers, you see. So it was pretty obvious. And you couldn't sort of cross every damn thing out. So you left it to a lot. I mean, most of them didn't bother. I remember once censoring one man's mail. He sent four different letters to four different women and said, "I am okay." And there were four. I mean, it was short and sweet. I mean, but it amazed me that he could send so many letters to so many different women, all the same thing. And